The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
When the FBI director, when any other government official, even at a low federal civil service level, assumes their position, they take an oath that they will uphold the laws of the country. We don't take oaths to a monarch. We don't take oaths to an individual. A person's responsibilities is to uphold the laws of the country. With respect to the FBI director, there is a heightened distancing. Although he does serve at the pleasure of the president and can be lawfully fired, he, by a law of Congress, has a 10-year term, which was different than all other political appointees, to insulate that role, which has a law enforcement function, which needs to conduct investigations independent of political influence, to a 10-year term.
I'm Quinta Jurisic, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, June 9th, 2017. Former FBI Director James Comey made a lot of news yesterday in his long-awaited testimony before the Senate Intelligence Committee. But what should we take away from what he said? To answer that burning question, we brought in two guests with some serious expertise on the matter. Benjamin Wittes sat down with Carrie Cordero, who formerly served in the National Security Division of the Justice Department, and Paul Rosenzweig, who formerly served under independent counsel Kenneth Starr during the Clinton administration, to talk Comey, what he said, what he didn't, and what this means for the Trump administration going forward. It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 232. Carrie Cordero and Paul Rosenzweig weigh in on Comey.
Let's start with just people's general impressions of what happened yesterday and what it means. Carrie, get us started. We saw the former FBI director give his account of his interactions with the president. What do you make of it?
Well, I'm actually going to start in a place that you might not expect, which is not on the various meetings and conversations between former Director Comey and President-elect and then President Trump, but actually, which is what was the most substantive and actually most important from a national security perspective fact that Comey reiterated, which was that there unequivocally, definitively, without a doubt, was Russian influence on the campaign. And I think we just need to keep that point at the fore going forward, that that doesn't get lost in all of the other soap opera related dynamics that are captivating everybody's attention.
So I look at that fact and I say one of the fascinating aspects of that is that in all of the interactions between Comey and the president, one thing he does not report is that the president ever expressed concern or interest in that fact as either a potential criminal matter or as a ongoing counterintelligence problem. What did you make of, I mean, by and large, Comey's testimony was not about that. It was about these interactions. But you want to read those interactions in light of that underlying fact. What's the interaction between the two?
Well, so on that particular angle, so again, they had numerous interactions. I mean, I think what was revealed through Comey's testimony aside from the major points that, that really came out in his written statement, and I don't think were that much elaborated during his oral testimony, which was that the president asked for a loyalty oath and that the president insinuated, requested, directed, however one wants to interpret it, that he make the Mike Flynn criminal case go away. Those are the two sort of dynamics between their interactions that came out. But what it underscores is that in all of these various interactions that they had, Jim Comey was the FBI director. He was the top counterintelligence officer that the president interacted with respect to domestic threats, with respect to FBI domestic counterintelligence, and the fact that the substance of this major national security threat was never discussed is relevant to the president's performance in his role as president and commander in chief.
Paul, what are your overarching thoughts? Yesterday, among other things, was incredible theater. And so give us the theater review. What'd you make of it?
Well, it was indeed amazing theater. Reminiscent in my mind of the time that Ken Starr testified in front of the House Judiciary Committee regarding Bill Clinton's impeachment. That was the last time that we had such a riveting set of testimony. To my mind, echoing what Carrie said, I think that the testimony made it clear that the key fact for Special Counsel Mueller going forward is finding any links, if they exist, between the obstruction piece of this investigation and the Russian interference piece of this investigation. I was very pleasantly surprised by the generally sober and effective performance of the Senate. That, you know, there were a couple of exceptions, of course, as there always are, but by and large, they treated this matter with the gravity and seriousness that I think it deserves, and mostly masked their partisanship, you know, in somewhat in the tenor of their questioning, but mostly masked it, and that's a positive for anybody who's actually looking at the Article I branches of this country to play an effective role in resolving whatever it is that needs resolving with respect to the specter of Russian interference. This was a pretty darn good day. And last, I would say that Jim Comey, personally, comes across as extremely credible and forthright. You may not like what he said, but it's pretty hard to think that any neutral finder of fact would discount what he said simply because they disagreed with it.
All right, so let's turn to how the evaluation of the story that he told. How bad a day was it for the president?
Moderately bad. It makes him look like he was trying to influence the investigation. I think that's kind of the fairest summary. He demanded loyalty. He asked him to put away the Flynn investigation. He asked him, you know, to help dissipate the Russian cloud over him, over his presidency. All of which are strikingly inappropriate actions, even if they don't rise to the level of obstruction of justice. We can talk about that in a second. I think that, you know, we're already seeing the president's response, which is, I came here to blow up Washington. I don't care about your norms. I didn't know that that's inappropriate. I'm not even sure it should be inappropriate. You guys are making a mountain out of a molehill, and I'm from New York. Suck it up, buttercup.
What do you think, Harry? Scale of 1 to 10, how bad a day is it for the president?
Maybe an 8. I think it was a bad day for him because it confirms through a very credible witness that he asked a FBI director who was supposed to have an apolitical 10-year term for his personal loyalty, which is frankly offensive to anybody who has served in government and taken the oath to the Constitution and to uphold the laws of the United States.
Okay, so wait, let me, you know, I've said this about a dozen times, and every time people say, you know, what's so wrong with loyalty? And so let me pause on that and just ask you to flesh that out. You're a Republican. You're a former Justice Department official at the career level. What's wrong with, if you're a holdover official from the prior administration, as Comey is, the administration changes party. The president doesn't know who you are politically, you know, and doesn't know, are you going to be one of these burrowers who's going to undermine him? So he invites you over to the White House and says, hey, can I count on your loyalty? I need that. Walk me through what is wrong with that.
So when the FBI director, when any other government official, even at a low federal civil service level, somebody who is an employee of the federal government assumes their position, they take an oath that they will uphold the laws of the country. I think there's a historical aspect to this, that we don't take oaths to a monarch, we don't take oaths to an individual. And so at the end of the day, a person's responsibilities is to uphold the laws of the country. With respect to the FBI director, there is a heightened distancing because he is, although he does serve at the pleasure of the president and can be lawfully fired, he, by a law of Congress, has a 10-year term, which was different than all other political appointees in that the 10-year term was intended to insulate that role, which has a law enforcement function, which needs to conduct investigations independent of political influence, to a 10-year term. And so I think that there is a special issue with respect to the president's asking loyalty of an FBI director, as opposed to sort of asking to some political special assistant, you know, are you going to help me achieve my policy objectives? And I do have one thought with the respect of the argument that the president really doesn't know better and he's a Washington neophyte and he really doesn't understand that he wasn't supposed to discuss an ongoing criminal investigation with the FBI director. Where is everybody else in government in his administration who is supposed to be advising him about those rules? There are long-standing traditions, written memorandum that govern contacts between the White House and the Justice Department, which includes the FBI, about discussing ongoing criminal investigations. And that's the White House counsel's job. That is the attorney general's job.
Paul, what do you think? Is there, you kind of raised your eyebrows when Carrie said it was an 8 on a bad day scale. You had said it was moderately bad. What's the mitigating factors for the president here?
Well, there are a couple mitigating factors for the president. The first is, Comey confirmed that he wasn't the subject of a CI investigation.
And why is that mitigating? I mean, in the sense that it wasn't like Comey had ever said he was.
Well, it's mitigating in the same way that it was, you know, mitigating for Hillary Clinton when Comey said she was not no longer the subject. Anytime the investigative agent who's in charge of looking at your conduct says he's not currently under investigation for that, you know, is rightly taken as a partial vindication of the view that there's no there, or if there is a there, it hasn't been, you know, exposed to the FBI. So that's the first thing. The second piece is that the descriptions of the discussions with the president, while I find them, you know, chilling and terrible, leave enough ambiguity, I think, that he's going to be able to make out a colorable case that he was. I mean, yeah, McGahn should have been in the room telling him not to do this, but he's got some reasonable defenses to make to the charge that he was obstructing justice. Not that, you know, that's a good thing that you're even being considered for the charge. Third, it turns out that Comey made at least are plausibly some missteps. I'm thinking particularly of the disclosure that he was behind, purposefully behind the leak of his memorandum as a means of trying to influence the appointment of a special counsel. I certainly don't think that was a crime or an ethics violation on Comey's part, but it does paint him as more of a manipulator of the process and less of the perfectly straight shooter, I'm just here to tell you the facts. I mean, his written statement was G-man, right? You know, just the facts, plain and simple. His emotive opening statement was just the facts with my anger at being manipulated by the president. And he loses a little bit of the second bit of that, the moral credibility with that. I think the third thing, or the fourth thing that mitigates this completely, is that at least the initial reaction in the Republican elected party is one of, we don't care. We're going to stick with him. Speaker Ryan, some of the senators. For me, this game is going to all be played out in the political sphere. And Comey's testimony didn't really move the dial, and I don't think it probably moved the dial with President Trump's hardcore of support. They really still are the group that he could go and shoot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue and they would disregard it. And Comey's testimony didn't move that needle. So if you want to see a change in the perspectives, you know, we're all, I think, rightly deeply appalled at what Comey reported. But it didn't move the geopolitical needle that much. So I give it a 4, 5, 6, something in that range.
Interesting. That's actually a pretty big gap between the two of you in terms of that. That's very interesting. So let's bracket the question of what punches were landed on Comey either by himself or by others for now, and let's finish up with the question of the impact for the president. And let's talk specifically about the obstruction question. We now have under oath a series of claims about a set of interactions, some of which the president disputed through his counsel last night, one of which the Justice Department disputed in terms of his interactions with the Attorney General. But the disputes, of course, are not under oath. And the parameters of the disputes are not clear. So my question for both of you, let's start with Carrie, is how seriously should we take the idea that there may have been an obstruction of justice here?
Well, one new fact that I think emerged through former Director Comey's oral testimony was a fairly definitive statement that the issue of obstruction is now under the purview of the special counsel. I'm not sure that before yesterday we had heard that clearly articulated. There have been various reports this week indicating that the special counsel was sort of working on determining how broad his investigation is going to be. And so that struck me as a fairly new fact to that Comey said specifically obstruction is going to fall under that investigation. So certainly special counsel is going to look at it. I think the fact that the Senate Intelligence Committee had the hearing that they had yesterday with Comey testifying specifically primarily on the interactions between himself and the president indicates that the committee is also now open to taking on the issue of obstruction, because that was really the purpose of the hearing. That was what his statement was geared towards. That's what the bulk of the questions were about. So that indicates to me that the committee is also taking the obstruction issue seriously. So I think there's enough indicators that the two major investigations that are taking place right now think it's serious, which means that it's serious. That being said, I think most legal observers agree that the likelihood of a president being charged with obstruction is highly unlikely, and that obstruction, if in fact a record were established through the special counsel investigation or the committee investigation that demonstrate factual support for elements of obstruction, that that would have to be resolved through the political process.
Paul, what do you think? How strong a case for obstruction do you think there is here, both if we consider obstruction as a statutory criminal matter, but also if you consider sort of the more colloquial sense of obstruction of justice that may be cognizable through the impeachment process?
Well, obstruction charges are notoriously easy to bring and hard to prove. And the reason they're difficult to prove in a court of law is because the critical component of corrupt intent is often, typically only provable by inference. Very few people publicly declare their corrupt intent as they act in doing their obstruction. Given the high burden of proof that attends any criminal charge and the added political benefit of doubt that will probably attend any trial of President Trump, it'll be a hard charge. Though I will say that the prosecutor does have the advantage that the venue for this is, if it were to exist, would be here in the District of Columbia, where the venire is probably as anti-Trump as you would ever find. So that's the flip of the Clinton administration, where the venire was in the district and it was pro-Democrat, and so it was an unlikely place to secure a conviction. So that makes it possible. And then I've also bracketed whether or not a sitting president can be indicted, because that's a theoretical question that has never been answered by the courts. I think it carries absolutely right that it will be a significant aspect of Mueller's criminal investigation that Trump could possibly worsen by ill-advised tweeting for himself
which he did this morning.
Yeah, gives greater rise to corrupt intent inferences. But my sense is that this is more likely to be resolved, if it's resolved at all, as Carrie said, as a political obstruction of justice consideration. It is notable that both Clinton and Nixon had articles of impeachment that sounded in obstruction of justice that basically sounded like severe attempts to manipulate the public perceptions and policy through ill-advised means, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, so like neither Clinton's obstruction charge nor Nixon's referred specifically to the statutes, right? Right. They were just basically, you used your power in a fashion so as to obstruct the due administration of justice. And if I were advising the House Judiciary Committee, assuming that there were members of the House Judiciary Committee who were even interested in the problem, I would say I'm not sure strict violation of the statute is the relevant question. The relevant question is sort of, is this an okay way for the president to behave with respect to the director of the FBI?
You're too weak. I would state it affirmatively. Violation of the statute is not the definition of obstruction of justice in the political context.
So how would you define obstruction of justice in the context that we're dealing with here, which is, you know, and if you're Mueller, how do you understand the relationship between your investigation, which for this purpose is a simple criminal investigation, and that standard? Carrie?
So this is a really important point. And John Carlin has an article, a piece of analysis out in the Washington Post this morning.
And I want to point out that he did not write it for Lawfare, and we're a little bit sore about that.
Well, I'm going to commend it to Lawfare listeners anyway. John Carlin, many of the Lawfare community knows him as the former Assistant Attorney General for National Security, but he also was the former Chief of Staff to the FBI under Director Mueller. And John's piece raises a very important point that Congress needs to think about, which is that even if the special counsel considers obstruction as part of its mandate, the current special counsel arrangement is very unclear regarding what is the deliverable if not criminal charges. So in other words, everybody has confidence that to the extent the special counsel in its broad investigation uncovers evidence of crime and believes that there are prosecutable offenses, it will pursue those in terms of criminal prosecution, whether that involves activities regarding Michael Flynn, whether that involves potential financial issues that are related to the Russian investigation. But let's say on the obstruction piece, if the special counsel does not get to a prosecutable offense, what is the mechanism for the special counsel to be able to provide its findings, whatever they are, to Congress? And John discusses this in his piece today, and it's a really important issue that needs to be thought about and perhaps addressed by Congress before we get to that moment in time.
So I just want to say on this, this is a problem that, Paul, you worked on specifically during the Starr investigation. And it's actually an aspect of the Starr investigation on which I wrote a book, which is, you know, the interaction between the investigative prosecutorial function under the old independent counsel law and the sort of truth commission function, which is embodied in the old statute in the final report requirement, which of course does not exist for the special counsel in the same way. And also, at least as Starr interpreted it, in the impeachment referral language of the old independent counsel statute, which he used to write a quite capacious and full document, which I think you would know this better than I, but I think he wrote with no particular understanding or expectation that Congress would dump the whole thing in the public's lap, essentially unread. And so I'm interested, Paul, in your, I have some of my own thoughts, but I'm interested in your thoughts on what's the right way for Mueller to understand his reporting function to Congress in reference to its impeachment power, particularly given that he's not operating under the old statute, and it was partly the use of the statute for this purpose by you people that caused Congress to not renew it, among many other things, of course.
My historical sense is that the Truth Commission investigative report functionality of the independent counsel was the most pernicious aspect of its existence. It authorized an unaccountable prosecutor to lay things before the public in ways that proved to be very corrosive, not because they were necessarily right or wrong, but because they occurred outside of the normal bounds of process. Not to say that it was a statutory, because it had a statutory authorization, but that authorization was just a bad idea. If Robert Mueller were listening to this podcast, my recommendation to him on that basis would be, you have no reporting requirement at all. You should exercise your functions just as you are any other special prosecutor. If you have crimes, bring them. If you don't, close it. If you think you need to make a report, you know, there is a mechanism. We can convene a special grand jury, which is a statutory provision that is allowed to conduct investigative reports, but that requires authorization, presumably here from the Attorney General, the Deputy Attorney General, though he's probably going to recuse himself any day now, given that there's an obstruction of justice investigation that involves him. So maybe the associate attorney general. You cannot, I would certainly be opposed to an ex post action by Congress to retroactively authorize a report from Mueller after he'd been appointed under the regulations. That seems to me like Trump-only law.
Right.
I've written about this a number of times. I don't think that we defend norms by creating new aberrant norms of behavior. Mueller, if he finds no criminality, that's the end of it. And, that's his job. Congress has to do its job.
So Jaworski did an impeachment referral in the Nixon administration, in the Watergate investigation. That document has interestingly never become public because it's it contains a whole lot of grand jury information. I think it is still under seal. But it has been characterized in some depth, both in Jaworski's memoir and in the memoir of his, I forget the name of the fellow, it's a wonderful book, the memoir of his spokesman. And he characterizes it as a very spare report that simply lists statutory statutory law, and then quotes grand jury, cites grand jury transcripts that may constitute violations of those statutes. So here's my question: I agree with you that Mueller is a prosecutor, and the right way for him to behave is as a prosecutor. But if we hypothesize that you guys are right, and I suspect based on the current record you're right, which is that there's a serious criminal obstruction of justice question. But when you actually get down to analyzing what you could prove in court beyond a reasonable doubt about the specific elements of specific offenses under Title 18, it's going to be a very hard case to make. And so in your prosecutorial hat, you say, okay, we've gone through all of it. We've checked all the boxes. We're not going to bring a case here, especially because he's the president of the United States and there's this question about whether we can. But boy, there's a rip-roaring question that the House Judiciary Committee should consider under its impeachment authorities based on the evidence that we've collected in front of the grand jury that we've convened. I agree with you, you don't follow the Starr model, but do you do nothing? Or do you follow the Jaworski model?
What's to stop the House Judiciary from conducting that investigation itself right now? If Mueller does even a Jaworski, and your characterization of his report is, I think, an accurate one, even if you do a Jaworski, that's the prosecutor, putting his thumb on the scales and trying to push it. Congress. There's no secret out there. If he uncovers something that is completely not in the public record, some connection between Trump and the Chinese that nobody is – this is a hypothetical podcast, listeners – but something that is not in the public record, then he has a problem because the Congress can't even bring itself around to investigating that of which it is unaware. But there's no mystery here. For the House Judiciary Committee, enough of the facts are out there that if they're interested in this, they can conduct their own investigation.
Okay, so that's a really interesting question. There is no talk of their doing that. So my question is, you are now talking to Bob Goodlatte, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. Your view is that we have two entirely independent tracks here that should be minimally, if at all, communicating with one another. Does that mean that Bob Goodlatte, based on the facts that are now public and Comey's testimony yesterday, has an affirmative obligation to be conducting an investigation of these events because they could, in some theoretical or factual constructions, raise an issue under the impeachment clauses?
So Bob Inglis is a former congressman from South Carolina. He was on the House Judiciary Committee during the Clinton impeachment times. I think he was even
one of the managers.
I think he was even one of the managers. And he was on CNN this morning saying if this were a Democratic president, the Republicans in Congress would have started an obstruction of justice impeachment inquiry already, and they should do so as well here.
Kerry, what do you think? Does the House Judiciary Committee have an independent obligation to open an impeachment inquiry now?
There certainly are a number of facts. I agree with Paul that there's a number of facts in the public domain that would justify it. I would think that they would want to do so in a way that simultaneously respects whatever investigation the Senate Intelligence Committee is doing. So I think there's a small risk of investigations kind of stepping on one another if, in fact, the Senate Intelligence Committee is now, as it appears to be, taking testimony on the obstruction issue. So there's sort of, so maybe there's a timing question, maybe there's a coordination question. And substantively on obstruction, if House Judiciary or other members of Congress, if they're waiting for there to be some definitive fact, in other words, one event or act that they think is the bombshell for obstruction, I would suggest that there's a different way to think about the potential obstruction issue, which is that there may not be one specific act by the president. There may not be one specific event that makes the case for obstruction, but instead what they might be looking at is a pattern of behavior and a sequence of acts and events and statements and tweets and actions that form the basis of the obstruction case.
Yeah, I think if there's an obstruction case here, either as a criminal matter or as an impeachment matter, it's fundamentally about an aggregation of activity, not about any single act. Kerry, I want to, before we turn to the what blows were landed on Comey question, I want to ask you specifically about an issue Paul raised, because you are one of the very few people who ever speaks publicly who really has hands-on experience with counterintelligence investigations. And, you know, Paul made the point, I think, you know, quite correctly, that one of the good things about the day for the president was that, you know, it really became quite clear that at least as of May 13th or May 9th, when Comey was dismissed, there was not an open counterintelligence file on Trump personally. And so my question to you is, how much good news is that for the president? Should we understand that as his conduct is not at issue in these investigations, or should we understand that in a much more limited kind of good news?
So former Director Comey, in his testimony yesterday, described an internal FBI leadership debate that took place on this particular point, which was that he was, I guess, deliberating over whether or not to tell the president that he was not the technical subject of a counterintelligence investigation. And the way that the former director described it yesterday was that there was at least one individual on his leadership team who disagreed with his decision to tell the president that he was not the subject of an investigation. And that was because, as he described it yesterday, that individual believed that because the FBI was conducting a more comprehensive investigation into Russian influence and potential involvement by the Trump campaign writ large, that that arguably could, whether it did X number of days or months ago or not, that could involve the president because it was his campaign. And I have to say that I found myself during his testimony yesterday aligning with the judgment of that individual who advised him.
In other words, you think it was ill-advised of Comey to tell the president that he was not under investigation?
I understand the reasons as he has articulated them, and I can respect them, but I find myself in more agreement with the advice that he was given by whoever was that member of his leadership team.
I agree with you.
That the broad scope of the investigation as it relates to his campaign potentially had the potential to involve him, and therefore it was not necessarily an advisable formulation for him to inform the president.
So if you were advising the president right now, which is admittedly not an admirable position to be in.
Do we also have to assume he would take our advice?
No, just like, I mean, if you were whispering in his ear, he's claiming vindication as a result of this. How much vindication should the president be claiming according to in the counterintelligence context, limited to that his campaign, his underlings, his family may all be subject to counterintelligence investigation, but he personally, at least as of May 9th, is not. How much, how should we understand that as to what Trump's exposure is to this counterintelligence investigation, or just do we just not know?
Well, that's the difficulty of a counterintelligence investigation being conducted under the daily public eye. I mean, this is an investigation that should have been conducted behind closed doors and not in the daily public eye. And so really, for someone advising the president, the advice should be he shouldn't be talking about it at all. He shouldn't be making any claims. He shouldn't be claiming vindication. He shouldn't be talking about it. He shouldn't be tweeting about it. He shouldn't be focusing on it. He should be doing the job of president, and he should be insulating himself from any ongoing investigation, because counterintelligence investigations traditionally take a while to conduct and to reach their conclusions.
Okay, let's turn to Jim Comey. Paul, you said he, came off as, earnest and likely telling the truth. You also say he punctured his own veneer of apolitical G-man straight shooterness with the disclosure that he called Dan Richman and asked him to give a document, one of the memos, to the New York Times. On a scale of 1 to 10, how bad a day for Jim Comey?
Oh, I think it was a good day for Jim. He came across as straight and credible, and to some degree, his own acknowledgement that he's imperfect strengthens his credibility. Right? He didn't try and hide the connections with the New York Times.
No, in fact, he actively volunteered.
Yeah, nor hide his motivation. But at the same time, the fact that he chose that course of conduct, back in May, when he did so, does make you think that he sort of has some pique or dismay or anger at the lies being told about him that drove him, to somewhat politicize his response. I think Jack Kingston, another, former Republican, who said, the frame in which we should read Comey's testimony is that he's just a disgruntled fired employee, that contributes somewhat to that storyline. I mean, I don't buy it, right? But if you're building things to say that mitigate the damage of his testimony, or that call its veracity into question, Everybody knows about the idea that people who get fired lie about why they were fired. And so this is kind of plays into that a little bit. It was a 2 on the damage scale, a misstep, but since it was his own goal, he could have had it made it a 0.
What do you think, Carrie? How big a problem is the Comey leaked to the New York Times through Dan Richman meme? And what other vulnerabilities emerge from the day for him?
Well, it gives his opponents and the president, who are now going on attack against the former director a talking point. I don't think there's much more damage beyond that. These allegations that are out there in the last 24 hours that somehow he committed a crime by doing that are just unfounded in law. There's no allegation at all that he released any classified information. He specifically said that he wrote up his notes specifically and deliberately in an unclassified way. So I think the damage done is that he gave his opponents a talking point and not much beyond that.
Actually, if you want to know what I think was the most kind of penetrating set of questions that were on the what about this Comey side, it was really the series of questions that suggested that he was too calculating in not actually being more forthcoming earlier about his perception that the president was improperly trying to influence him. You know, he did say that we gave some thought to whether or not we should, you know, expose this more widely, go to the attorney general, to, you know, and talk not just don't leave me alone with him, but expose, you know, what he had said. And there is some fairness to the argument that, you know, if at the time you really thought it was so bad that you had to write memos about it, you know, you perhaps should have been sending up a bigger red flare. And again, that doesn't mean that what he said is untrue, but it's one of those things that any defense lawyer would say is indicative that at least at the time you didn't think it was important enough to mention to the attorney general. Now you think it's important enough to tell the whole world.
Right. So I actually think that's the more substantial criticism than that after the president fires him and lies about him and lies about the reason for firing, he doesn't consider himself bound in to confidentiality to the president and shares a personal memo that he wrote or even an unclassified government document. I'm not even sure which it is, to be honest, but he describes it as his own memo to file, basically. I don't think I think that's kind of a trivial suggestion that there's something improper about giving that to the New York Times. That said, I do think there's a more substantial question. Why didn't you ask the president, hey, this is really, you know, why didn't you say to the president, this is really inappropriate? Why didn't you do more at the time? And I think the subtextual answer to that question, first of all, I thought his response to that was really interesting, that he seemed, you know, cautious, but very amenable to the idea that he was insufficiently bold at the time. And I thought that was interesting that he said, you know, if I'd been more courageous, I might have done X, Y, and Z. But the second element that I think is really a key factor here is that all of this looks different in the light of the fact that he was fired, right? And in light of the statements the president made about why he was fired. And I think the analogy I keep coming back to about this is if you have a pattern of bad conduct that may be suggestive in a sexual harassment context in a workplace, and that somebody's getting the feeling that, you know, there's some, you know, if you don't do the following, you might have, your job might be on the line, and there's some suggestion of that, but it's not dispositive. There's no great or direct order, right? But then you fire her, right? It all looks very different. And I think there's a bit of that, that all of this looks very different, in fact, because we know what the outcome was.
But who was he going to tell?
Yeah.
He was conducting an investigation that involved, at the time, the attorney general, who he knew was going to have to recuse himself. And this is a rudderless administration.
Right. No, I think
who was he going to tell when the very investigation that he is conducting is about the campaign and individuals who served on the transition of that campaign, who then assumed senior government positions?
I mean, I think if I had been counseling him at the time, which I was not, for the record, and I had known about this. The question that I might have raised, although I might not have had the presence of mind to do it, is should you tell the Intelligence Committee leadership, right? Should you sit down with Mark Warner and Richard
Burr? Or the Judiciary Committee leadership, right, who are your respondents?
And say, I just had an incredibly disturbing conversation with the president that has implications for the counterintelligence investigations and some criminal investigations, and you need to know about it. And it's not a direct remedy, but it is at least telling somebody and doing something. So we got to close out, but thoughts on that? Is that what Comey should have done?
I would have sent it to the Attorney General, who had not yet recused, and the then acting, with a CC to the then acting Deputy Attorney General, so you know that it actually made it to an official who was not necessarily implicated in this. I mean, you do understand the inconsistency. You know, this was so extraordinary a meeting that he felt the need to write a memo about it, something he'd never done for Obama. So it's more than just kind of that I'm feeling uncomfortable. I'm feeling so uncomfortable that I'm making a memo for the file, but I'm not going to tell anybody. It's a little bit of a weak spot for him. And I honestly think his answer was the accurate one, that he was overly cautious. He lacked the courage of his convictions. He was being a little bit CYA-ish. And that's okay. Humans are humans, you know. That's the nature of the beast.
What do you think, Carrie?
I think that we need to remain open to the idea that there are still, despite as much information as there is in the public domain, there are still aspects of this investigation that have not been revealed publicly. Some of those facts perhaps were relayed to the Senate Intelligence Committee yesterday in their closed session that took place after his public testimony. But there perhaps are reasons that are contained in those facts that are still classified that might explain more his behavior at the time.
We're going to leave it there. Carrie Cordero, Paul Rosenzweig, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. As ever, our music is performed by Sophia Yan. We're getting lots of new listeners these days, so if you haven't already, please do support the podcast and spread the word by giving us a rating and review in the iTunes Store. As always, thanks for listening.
Step onto the legendary clay courts of Roland Garros, where the world's best players battle it out for a chance to win the French Open title. Tennis Channel Plus is your place to watch. Stream every court from your phone or smart TV, live in HD. Don't miss a moment with daily live coverage and match replays on demand, beginning Monday, May 20th. Be there for all the unforgettable moments. Stream now with Tennis Channel Plus.